Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the third argument that is scheduled on our calendar this morning. We're just a little bit behind schedule. I saw that both counsel were here on time, though, so you get brownie points for that, and thank you for your patience. The case is Patrick Wandersee et al. Versus Ram Mutual Insurance Company, case A21-1060. Before we jump into your arguments this morning, counsel, I just want to inquire whether you can both see the clock on the screen, which will be counting down your time.
I can.
I can too.
Okay, great. So each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments, and counsel for the appellant will then also have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Are you both ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. Paragraph 19 of the complaint says the subject policy covers the peril of fire, thus triggering a duty to write a policy that conforms in all respects to the form policy language of Minnesota Statute 65A, Subdivision 1. And that statute says that if a property insurance policy is going to be issued and it covers the peril of fire, it's got to have certain language in that policy, including an appraisal clause, or else the policy needs to be reformed to meet the statutory minimums. And that's the Watson v. USAA case. These are minimum protections given to all Minnesota property owners. And in paragraph 19 of the complaint, the Wandersees alleged that this policy needs to mirror the form statutory language. And in response, at document 13, page 10, there's a memorandum of law filed by Ram, and it argues in relevant part that no, they can deny the insured appraisal because the appraisal occurred after a policy deadline of 1 year, but that policy deadline is not found in the form policy language from the statute.
Mr. So, Beckman, you're leading into a initial question, somewhat procedural, that I have for you, and that is, it sounds like you're getting to the first of the district court's order related to the alternate service and whether the court properly concluded alternate service on the commissioner was not met for lack of pleading pursuant to the statute 65A. Am I correct?
Yes.
Now, you did not appeal that order. The only order on appeal, as I understand it, is the second order, which referenced the dismissal, granted the respondent's dismissal motion based on the statute of limitations, and then also analyze the referral back under 1503 language. And so my question is, we don't review substantively orders that are not on appeal. Is not, therefore, the only issue before us what you've identified as issue number three, whether the district court in the appealed order of dismissal properly construed the law as it relates to an amended complaint, and whether it was properly concluded that it cannot relate back pursuant to the Van Sluten case to a dismissed complaint for lack of personal service, therefore no jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I believe I appealed on behalf of the Wandersees both orders, because the first order could only be a timely appealed after the second order, because the first order did not dispose of the case. It was an order for dismissal without prejudice, and the case continued.
But isn't it true? Well, two things. Your statement of the case does not identify the first order, if I recall correctly and looking at it. But secondly, is it not true that the Supreme Court has identified as an appealable order one that dismisses a case on grounds of lack of personal jurisdiction? And so your client did have an appealable order, notwithstanding a lack of judgment language from that first dismissal?
I don't believe so, because the Court of Appeals, the District Court held that the case continued. And that, you know, there's language in there about, the court reserving judgment on some of the arguments. There is language in there about All prior orders will continue in full force and effect. So my understanding of the proper procedure is that because that was not dismissed with finality, that we had to wait until the court ruled on the subsequent motion for dismissal, and then appeal was only timely on both of them. Because remember, the second order for dismissal does reference the first. The second order states that because there was a dismissal previously for lack of jurisdiction under 45028, therefore we can address it here today, because the second order in large part, it actually turns on the fact that service was allegedly not proper.
But isn't the reason, if I understand correctly, the reference to the order is simply the court's historical and legal reality that your client's complaint was dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction, or lack of service, I should say, which then causes a lack of personal jurisdiction. And so that would be why the court was referencing it in relation to the title amended and the argument respondent made that, and the court agreed with, that you can amend a dismissed complaint. And Van Sluten was the precedent that the court cited. Am I correct? Or if I'm not, please correct me.
Well, as I read the order for dismissal, the second one, order on motions to dismiss filed June 22, 2021, there again is findings of fact by the court. And then this is at addendum 8-9, and then conclusions of law. And the conclusions law of the district court states, a civil lawsuit is commenced upon service of summons upon defendant. Service in this matter was completed on March 12, 2021, over 6 months before the 2-year window to bring suit. And then the district court analyzes the Wondersee's argument that plaintiff suit was proper. And then we get into the third argument of mine, yes, the rule 15.03, but we're only there because of the first dismissal and without prejudice in the ongoing case at the courthouse. So I'm sorry if that doesn't answer the court's question, but the court did analyze whether or not the amended complaint relates back. And
maybe I'll just ask it a little slightly different way. Isn't sure. It true that it's the first order in which the court analyzed the substance, the legal substance of its dismissal for failing to properly serve? And it's the second order which simply recites what it had already concluded and analyzed, and then cited Van Sluten. Therefore, because the complaint was dismissed, we now cannot amend or relate back to a dismissed complaint. Therefore, it violates the statute of limitations and granted dismissal. Would that be a fair colloquy of the between the two orders?
Yes.
The district. Okay.
Yes, it would be.
So that then gets my first question. Why would we then, if your client only appealed that second order, at least that's how I see your statement of the case, would we even get to issues 1 and 2?
Well, as I look at the statement of the case, number 5 lists specific issues proposed to be raised on appeal. Number 1, can appellant's claims be dismissed when the initial complaint rose under MnSTAT section symbol 65A01 as required for service of process under statute 45.028? And then number 2, does the amended complaint relate back? And then number 3, whether RAM can write a policy with an appraisal limitation. So I do think that number 5 lists the specific issues raised on appeal that would encompass the first order.
Can I just ask, is your argument in this case dependent on the first order being wrongly granted?
No.
Are you challenging the merits of the decision on the first order?
Yes, in part, but also that the second order was erroneously issued as well.
Okay, so you say if the district court was wrong in the first order in dismissing it, that is one basis. But even irrespective of that, you're saying you still have an argument in your favor without respect to the merits of the first order. Is that right? And that's the relation back?
That's the relation back argument. That's absolutely correct. So I can handle the relation back first if the court would like. And under the case law we've cited, in particular Nelson v. Greenwood, the relevant issue for whether it relates back is whether the prior service of process gave the parties notice of the claims being asserted. In fact, I think the court held, if service of summons and complaints results in an intended defendant being fully informed as to the circumstances of the action, the court has acquired sufficient jurisdiction over that defendant. And because the original complaint and the amended complaint are so similar, and I'm not sure there's a strong, I don't think there's any argument to the contrary, that it does in fact relate back to the first.
But Mr. Beckman, doesn't the relating back doctrine refer or apply only to cases that have actually been validly served and filed in the district court? In other words, doesn't the district court's first order which basically says there's no action of dismissing this, preclude you from using the relating back argument?
I don't think so, because under the Nelson v. Glenwood, what happened is that the party that was added later received the original summons and complaint. And so it was simply a name change. That was really the only difference in Nelson v. Glenwood. So because they received the paperwork, that's sufficient to relate back. I'm not sure it's really a personal jurisdiction question, as the district court held. The amendment back is really about proper service and whether there was notice. That's under the Nelson v. Glenwood case. And because there was here, there's really no argument that there's a major distinction between the original complaint and the amended complaint, and they were proper, they were served. They got it. There's no question they got it. That is how the Nelson v. Glenwood case law falls in this state about relating back.
Can I ask? I mean, it's not unheard of that A sues B, messes up the service on B, statute of limitations run, they sue again, they're out of luck. I mean, clearly those cases exist, right? Even though it's just A and B, there are two parties, there's no substitution of parties. You're just out of luck. I think that, I don't know if you're arguing, no, you can always bring that second untimely complaint and just say it relates back. Or are you saying it's only in this case where the idiosyncratic thing about this case where the district court held on to the case and didn't end at that first dismissal?
I think it's both the fact that the court held on to the case and it was still on file with the courthouse, but also I do think that the facts here, the relevant facts, align with Nelson v. Glenwood, because there's no argument that when Ram got the amended complaint, there was brand new allegations totally out of the blue that they didn't know or understand.
But wouldn't that be the case in every, the result of that, I think, would be, and maybe this is a result you're seeking and maybe there's authority for it, that if there's improper service from A on B, and then the statute of limitations, case dismissed, statute of limitations run, and then A again sues B, that's always, the statute of limitations is satisfied in all those cases, then you could say.
Well,
as long as you bring the identical complaint, you just serve it right, but it's untimely the second time. You're saying that should just always then be a relation back.
Well, in this particular case where the court held on to the file, the amended complaint does conform, I believe, to what the district court was looking for in terms of greater specificity about 65A01. And I don't think that that's going to happen very often. I think that this is a really unique case where the court did retain the an act of an open file. And so I don't think this is going to create a new precedent that is going to be universally held, because when there's usually a lack of jurisdiction, the case is dismissed with prejudice.
But here was the district court aware of the statute of limitations? I mean, is it possible that the district court dismissed it without prejudice just to enable you to you know, file another complaint under the assumption that you would have an opportunity to do so, you know, within the statutory timeframe?
During the original motion practice that led to the original dismissal, I don't recall anybody raising statute of limitations. The issue raised was the appraisal demand was untimely because it wasn't within 1 year of the date of loss, but that's, you know, from the policy, that's not the statute of limitations found in 65A01 subdivision 3. So it was never handled in the original motion practice. I don't think so, because it was served within 3 days of the 2 year statute of limitations. Also, I think what's unique about this case is the 45.028 gives us very unique and different instructions for service of process, which is why the outcome of this case will not be applicable to really any other cases other than those served under 45.028. And so that, you know, I see that I'm out of time and I want to be respectful of the time, but I just asked the court to take a look at the briefing, which does talk about the unique features of what is service of process here. It's not filing the complaint at the courthouse. It's at most filing the affidavit of compliance, which did occur, but I'm out of time. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. And you will have the opportunity to speak with us again during your rebuttal after we hear from counsel for respondent. And speaking of counsel for respondent, you're up, Mr. Pyrus. And can you please just state your name and who you represent as well before you proceed with your argument?
Good morning, Bo Pyrus on behalf of the respondent this morning. May it please the court, I appreciate the opportunity to appear. The statement of the case, the jurisdictional statement, specifies the June 23rd order as being the one being appealed from. Of course, our position that we've explained is that the March 2021 order was a dismissal without prejudice.
Was that an appealable order at that time? I mean, what's appealable to us as an order might be a different question, of course, as to what orders are fairly comprehended in the appeal and subject to our review. So was that an appealable order at that time, the first dismissal?
We did not brief that issue. The unique issue, I believe, in this case, and the reason one of the reasons we didn't brief the case is the court did issue this order, but I do not believe that the court administration ever entered judgment. We did try to figure out why that was, and we just don't know the ramifications of that. We address the merits of it rather than the appealability issue of it.
It's conceivable that, and I appreciate your candor talking about this, it's conceivable, perhaps it's uncertain or at least not briefed as to whether that was an appealable order. So then the question is it then a reviewable order within this case? And is it your argument that it's not reviewable by us?
We haven't taken a decision or a position on that. And again, I don't want to say, yes, that's not something that you should look at. I do know that the order was entered by the court. Judgment was not subsequently entered by court administration. And we did not spend the resources to research that issue. Beyond that.
Mr. Pyrus, can I ask you, Mr. Beckman a couple times made reference to, and that was in response to my questions about whether we could review the order, but in any event, the dismissal, and the judge did use some interesting language that this doesn't affect any pre-existing orders, and I can't remember the other language, I don't have it right in front of me, but did say without prejudice, dismiss the appellant's cause of action. So what did that mean to you? What was left pending? Let's assume there never was an amended complaint filed. What would have happened with this case?
When I read that, I used to clerk for the district court. And when I read that, it was my assumption that it was just left over. There was no prior orders. I don't believe there was any intention to retain the case. There was some questions about whether or not the court was aware of the limitations period in March. And I don't know if it's a finding of fact on page, finding of fact, I think number three, the court does, you know, list the suit limitations. So there was an awareness of what was happening in this case. So I believe that the court dismissed it. I think the court in its subsequent order explained that it knew the ramifications of its decision with respect to the limitations period. And it did. It did. There was no ongoing issues. There were no prior orders to hang on to. There was no jurisdiction following that first dismissal. And so we've cited, you know, we've argued the relation back issue. And there is no case law where a case gets dismissed and then they try to relate back to an improperly served complaint where the court has lost jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, finish your statement. I had a bit of a follow-up question to your last statement.
Well, I was going to talk about the process to amend. So if you want to ask your question.
Well, wouldn't it be true then if we concluded that the first order was before us substantively, that your point on the last issue you were about discussing, the relating back, would be contingent on whether we agree or disagree? If we disagreed with the court's substantive analysis of the alternative service, then obviously then you have a complaint, or at least an arguably a related back, if the court erred in dismissing the complaint, which was before the end of the statute of limitations. Am I correct?
I believe you're correct, Your Honor. I mean, if the court decides that that the district court improperly, if we get to the substance of that issue, and this court finds that the district court had jurisdiction, that completely changes the whole framework. I think we would the issue would go back to the district court. And, you know, I think we would have to give the district court an opportunity to address that circumstance. And I think it is a little bit of a different circumstance. But the court still would have the discretion in that case on the motion to amend. Obviously, we've cited the process that one has to go through to amend a pleading. And the appellants in this case were beyond the time to unilaterally amend their complaint. And so they needed either the respondent's consent, which obviously they didn't get, or you need to request permission to the district court to bring a motion. You have to request permission, and then you have to bring a motion, and then the court has to grant that motion before you can even file an amended complaint, before you can even amend your complaint.
Mr. Pyrus, on that, since the district court didn't get to that issue, if we were to agree with appellant's counsel, and if we were reviewing the first order, and if we disagreed with the courts, would it have to be remanded? Then you would then make that argument and allow the court to agree or disagree. In other words, it wouldn't be an ending point. We wouldn't consider that if we got all the way through those dots to that point you just made.
Correct. I think the court has discretion whether or not to allow an amended complaint, whether or not to allow somebody to bring a motion for an amended complaint. So if that initial decision was in error, I think we have to give the court an opportunity to address whether or not an amended complaint is going to be allowed. Obviously, for a lot of these types of situations, there's often a competing motion to or request to amend a complaint along with somebody moving to dismiss a complaint in an attempt to try to do what the appellants did and try to fix, you know, some of the pleading requirements. And that didn't happen here. And so there was a subsequent, the case was dismissed, and there was a unilateral just attempt to amend, and they didn't go through the process. So I think it would go back to the district court. Just because I don't get another opportunity, I don't know what's going to happen here. 5 minutes following mine. Just on the substance of that first order, we had kind of a team document drafting here, and we, in doing that, violated kind of the number one rule of legal writing. And I would direct the court to page 13 of our memo, of our brief, where we cite three cases: the Eggy case, the Hadler case, and Berkshire Life. And all of those, two of them are unpublished, and the other one's a federal district court case. But all of those are very clear that this is a jurisdictional issue. Pleading the specific violation, the specific area of law that you're going under in a complaint, is a jurisdictional issue. It's an important moment in time to start a case. And the only time that 45.028 appoints the Commissioner of Commerce to be the receiver of service is if there's been a violation. And so on page 13 of our brief, those three cases specifically say that you have to specifically, because it's a jurisdictional issue, you have to specifically state what the violation is. And in this case—
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Pyrus? The language you used struck me as a little bit strong as I looked at those cases. In other words, as I looked at those and they're applying it to the statute, they are clear that the statute and the four elements must be strictly complied with, one of which there must be an allegation of a violation, of course, of the statute. That's really the one we've been dealing with and the district court did. But isn't it true that they did not comment separately in terms of the notice pleading requirement? It's saying you got to comply with the statute for alternative service, but notice pleading. So let's say hypothetically here on the 27th of August, they simply allege, but, and I realize they didn't, I think they admitted that your client had 20 days to appoint an appraiser, but let's assume they simply say in the complaint, the violation of appointing an appraiser within 20 days occurred. That's all they would need to say in the complaint to have a valid notice pleading on that, a violation of 65A. Am I correct about that?
They would need an actual violation. And the Hadler—
And that would do it, right? I mean, one of the violations could be not appointing an appraiser within the statutory, which also has the contractual timeline.
Right. I mean, so they have cited just generically to 65A, and the Hadler versus White Bear Lake Court, again, it's not a published case, but 1998, says that you don't get to just generically cite to the statute. It says the appellant's complaint broadly alleged that respondents breached the insurance contract and their statutory duties. And they found just a broad statement that their statutory duties were not being followed is not sufficient. And so that's why in that case, that court dismissed it. And even though there was these generic citations to 65A. And so 65A really, first of all, is not something that is made actionable. It in a declaratory judgment action or in a breach of contract action, it just serves to, if it's determined that the language is different or if it offers less coverage, the language is just inserted. So it's not something that's made actionable. The two actions here are the declaratory judgment action and the breach of contract action. So there's nothing that's made actionable here in 65A.
But so even Mr. Pyres, so that means an ADEC action is obviously fairly common in insurance disputes. Is your point that if even in the amended complaint where they claim that we had a loss and it wasn't because it was denied, it wasn't paid, they violate the contract, your point being that would not provide a basis under the alternative statute because that would just simply be a breach of contract and only breach of contract. And so there would have to be personal service in the normal course for that to be proper jurisdiction to the court.
I think, yes, that's what we've argued. I think that that it needs to be made actionable. It needs to be brought under. There needs to be a violation. And I don't think the simply non-conformance with 65A, but even if it did, even if that was, and this isn't before us because they did not allege any specific violations or any specific non-compliance with 65A, but even if they did, they would have to specifically allege what it is, and they have to specifically ask for reformation. And they didn't do that. They have, reading through the complaint, we have no idea what was not complied with and what they're asking the court to reform pursuant to 65A. There's just generic citation to sites or to rights under or to provisions under 65A. And they're saying, and it's exactly the Hadler case where it's just a general generic citation to the statute. And the only time that the commissioner is appointed is if there's a violation. You know, they could have gone through the standard service process. There's somebody there, you know, there's people sitting at the desk every day. They could have gone through the specific, you know, through the standard service process, but they chose an alternative means of service. And that's why there's strict compliance required. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Beckman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The amended complaint at paragraph 19, 20, 21, and 22 gives the exact specificity sought by the respondent, which is that to make sure that the policy conforms to the statutory language with citations to Watson, we have the magic word reformation. But really, the first original complaint says the same thing. The subject policy covers the peril of fire, thus triggering a duty to write a policy that conforms in all respects to the foreign policy language of 65A01. So they read that, and what they do? Motion to dismiss because they have a one-year deadline to demand appraisal. They understood quite clearly the relief we sought, so much so they argued against it in their initial opening brief. They can't now say, well, they didn't really understand. We were looking for, you know, a policy that conforms to the statute when they argued against it in their initial brief. And that's document 13 at page 10. With respect to the issue of...
Isn't one of the problems here, though, Mr. Beckman, that there was actually no violation of the statute at the time the complaint was served?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because they eventually agreed to go to appraisal, but then they choose not to honor the award. Well, that's a distinction without a difference. They made my client pay for an appraisal, you know, a half the umpire and an appraiser, and then decided not to honor the award because of the alleged one-year deadline. So, I mean, it's really a distinction without it. You know, my client did not have the luxury of knowing exactly.
If we're relating back to the complaint, you know, when it was filed and the events that were occurring at that time, there technically was no violation of the statute, right?
I think that there was because they wrote a policy with a one-year deadline to demand appraisal, and that was known at the time. And you can't, the argument is you cannot do that under 65A01. The peril includes fire. It's got to have the claim can be brought anytime within 2 years. And so that is a violation. We also didn't know how they would react to the appraisal award. So perhaps they would have said to the appraisal award, we don't agree that we have to pay for things required by the building codes. Well, that's in paragraph 18 of the complaint. That's a reference to 65A10. Again, we just don't know at the time how they're going to react to the demand for appraisal or the eventual appraisal award. That's why we have hypothetical pleadings in the state and hypothetical facts, because you know, there's no way we could have known. we can't guess what they're going to do.
Isn't that always the case in these losses when there's the deadline of a statute of limitations? And so I assume if your client had asked for it a year earlier, you would know. And if they don't comply, that's the reason for the alternative service, because now you've got a violation you can allege specifically.
I suppose, yes. But on August 27, we don't know how they're going to react to the demand for appraisal. It's probably likely that they're going to reference the one-year deadline, but they decided to appraise, but then not honor the award because of the one-year deadline. I mean, we just don't know how they're what they're going to do. And so, we can't be totally speculative about what they might do in the pleadings. The best we can do is say, we have a valid demand for appraisal. It should be honored. And I think that was appropriately treated in paragraphs 15 and 16 of the complaint. And then, of course, the complaint does ask for more. But
can I ask a question, which, I'll just say it might reveal ignorance on my part, which is not, the first time. But so you're arguing that the statute requires that the appraisal deadline and the deadline for bringing suit both be 2 years. Is that right?
Effectively. That is because if
doesn't that create the problem that yours kind of would be in if you ask for the appraisal and there's 20 days to do it, if the deadlines are the same? Wouldn't that be you're saying that the statute requires that, but does that make sense to require them to be the same, given the problem of you have 20 days to comply and then you run past the 2 years anyway?
Well, I think that the foreign policy language from the statute is what governs here, and that allows 2 years to pursue a claim. Also, within 2 years, you can demand an appraisal. So a one-year deadline is just, it's an impossibility. It's contrary to what the legislature provides. And
I'm not understanding the impossibility, I guess, if you have a year to...
Okay.
For the appraisal and 2 years to sue, I'm missing something.
Okay, in their view of the world, if there's a one-year deadline to demand appraisal and have that be honored, then effectively the claim dies after 1 year, because appraisal is the forum to decide the amount and scope of loss with finality, and that's Quaid v. Secura, also the foreign policy language. When the two sides disagree, appraisal. Now, my client, within the 1 to 2 year time frame, apparently in their view, doesn't even have the right to that. That's not what the legislature said. The legislature said you get 2 years to bring a claim and was totally silent on a deadline to demand appraisal. So it's less than what my client allowed. I know I'm out of time, but can I give a brief citation to when the when a judgment is appealable?
Go ahead and wrap up.
Okay. In a case, in an order filed in the Court of Appeals, A210740, the Court of Appeals did handle what constitutes an appealable judgment. There's a citation to Rule 58.01 and Schaust v. Town Board, 204 Northwestern 2nd, 646, 648. A judgment has to be entered and signed by the court administrator in the judgment roll, or it's not effective. For entry of judgment, and therefore it's not appealable. And so we didn't have that with the first order. Thank you for your time. I'm grateful you let me go over time. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you both for your arguments today. The case is now submitted and we'll issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. The end of this argument ends our oral argument session this morning. We are now going to recess to consider our non-oral cases. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.